Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to, I guess, for the one-off, one-time, early in the morning for those on the West Coast. Maybe this is a more convenient time for some of you in Europe. I see Stuart is on from Hawaii, so he must have gotten up at 2 a.m. this morning in order to listen to the show. All right, today we take on what I think is actually a pretty complex issue. And the issue is really how to vote. What should be the criteria by which one chooses a candidate? Now, if we lived in a laissez-faire capitalist economy, if we lived in a free world, then the choice in terms of voting would be relatively simple. The variations, the differences between the candidates would be relatively small. The power of government would be minimal. It would have little involvement in our day-to-day lives, in our business lives, in our scientific lives, in our educational lives. Government would be out of all of those areas. Consequence, while there would still be things that one would have disagreements about, I don't know, the length of patents, certain applications of property rights, maybe certain applications of foreign policy, certain details. Basically, government would be small, very, very limited, very, very limited in its power and its impact on our lives. And the choice to vote would be, more about one's opinions about some various technical issues. My guess is that not that many people would vote in a completely free society. It wouldn't be deemed as that important because again, what you're voting for is relatively as compared to today, less important. It has less applicability to one's own life. The complexity comes in. Now, let me also give you another scenario where it's relatively easy to decide on how to vote. So, again, in a free society, I think a lot of people wouldn't vote. I think voting wouldn't be perceived as that important. I think the discussion would be quite technical in terms of the differences between the candidates. I don't think you'd have anywhere near the kind of campaigns we have today. Certainly money wouldn't be spent like it is today. They wouldn't be able to raise that much money because they wouldn't be able to offer people favors in exchange for money. There'd be a lot less corruption because government wouldn't have as many favors to offer people. So in those cases, it wouldn't necessarily be easy to vote, but it would be less important. And it would be, I think, fewer people would be involved in politics. Voting, counter to what the left and many in our culture believe, voting is not a primary right. Voting is not the most important thing in the world. Voting, particularly in a free society, in a truly free society with a limited government, voting is a derivative right from the right to life. Of course, that's true in all societies, but in a free, limited government society, exercising your vote, it becomes less important. All right. When is it really, really important? So let's take the other extreme, if you will, where everybody should vote, where it's crucial to vote, where it really is a part of one's responsibility to one's own values and one's own life, important to vote. Well, it's crucial to vote when there is clearly a candidate who would either destroy the country, or where there's clearly a candidate who has the potential to save the country. That is, when it is clear-cut, not a choice between two evils, but somebody who's so evil that one cannot condone him becoming president or her becoming president, or when there's somebody so good that it is incumbent on one to vote for that person. So in situations in which there is clearly a choice, there is clearly black or white, and in some cases black and white, then I think it is crucial for one to vote, and more than vote. I think this is the case in which it is essential that one campaign, one advocate for, one invest money, one really dedicate oneself. And you can tell from Ayn Rand, pain she got involved in, she got passionate about. Of course, she also learned from these campaigns, but she got involved in the Wilkie campaign. And she got involved. This is 1940. And why did she get involved in that campaign? Because it was clear to her that FDR was driving the country into oblivion. Wilkie sounded good, although as the campaign went on, he sounded less good, and she became less enthusiastic about it. And of course, after the campaign, after he lost, he became a Me Too FDR, big government kind of candidate. But for a while there, it really seemed like you had to fight the evil that was FDR, and that there was actually a candidate who would stand up against FDR and had policies that would undo the evils of the New Deal. Now, she learned from this. I think Ayn Rand learned from this. I think we should all learn from this, that often these guys sound better than they really are. And that over time, given the philosophical nature of our culture, they cannot hold on to any kind of free market, any kind of capitalist, any kind of freedom agenda, because altruism and collectivism just chip away at them. And there's almost nobody out there who can withstand kind of pressure, that kind of intensity. So they give in. So when looking at candidates, one has to calibrate to that. To what extent is a candidate really good? Is what he's saying real? Is what he's saying, can what he's saying withstand the pressure that comes later, the pressure from altruism, from collectivism, and from all its representatives in industry, in labor unions, in Congress, among the public, among all the different pressure groups that exist out there? Is a candidate capable of withstanding those kind of pressures? One wonders about, for example, Ted Cruz endorsing Donald Trump. Is he the kind of candidate who can withstand pressures? Well, if he folded on this, one wonders if many of his other better claims about capitalism or about free markets, about cutting government spending, or about other things that got a lot of us enthusiastic about certain parts of his agenda, whether he could have withstood, whether he would have actually stood by those things, given that he didn't stand by his refusal to endorse Donald Trump, which, given how Donald Trump insulted him personally, one wonders how one could ever get around to endorsing Trump. So that's an example, right? I think another example historically of such a case like that was 1972, McGovern and Ayn Rand's view of Nixon was negative, was very mixed. She didn't like Nixon. Nixon was a compromiser. She said he was for the mixed economy, but he stood on the side of free markets within the scope of a mixed economy. So he wasn't going to destroy. Now, I have to say, I probably disagree with Ayn Rand. My evaluation of Richard Nixon, from at least from economics perspective, from his what he did, from an economic freedom perspective, is much, much more negative than hers. Many of the federal agencies today, the regulatory agencies that we suffer under today, like the Environmental Protection Agency, were instituted by the Nixon administration. He was just awful. Price controls, inflation ultimately, his choice of the Federal Reserve chief, and just everything he did policy-wise from an economic perspective, it was awful. On the other hand, he did end the draft. So you have to give him credit. That's a major, major win for freedom. And by the way, for those of you who don't know, Ayn Rand had a lot to do with the fact that he ended the draft. There were basically two people within it with links to the administration. There were strong advocates against the draft, and those were Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman. And Ayn Rand definitely had an influence on Martin Anderson, who was a very important advisor to Richard Nixon, and was on the commission, whatever, to end the draft, and was a strong advocate for ending it and helped do that. So Ayn Rand definitely had an influence on the Nixon administration, which is part of why I think she had, you know, more favorable view of Nixon than I would have. But McGovern was clearly a power-lusting status as far, you know, the worst candidate in terms of socialism that the country had ever seen, probably to that point. And she would pretty much, so she strongly advocated voting for Nixon as a signal as to knock down this really horrific threat from McGovern. So she wanted to send a signal, which I think the country did send a signal and really crushed McGovern, which I think ultimately led to Reagan's victory in 1980. But the radical left was defeated thoroughly in 1972, and that's what she wanted. She wanted the generation of the 60s, the new left, to be crushed, and it was. And it didn't really come back into politics until Obama was elected, until Elizabeth Warren came to the Senate, and really Bernie Sanders, his campaign recently. So that left that was crushed in 1972 is back with a vengeance today. But, you know, she advocated strongly for voting for Nixon for that reason. So that's on the negative side. That's to stop evil in its tracks. One has to vote. If something is so evil, and there is some alternative, even if it's far, far from perfect alternative, one has to vote to stop evil. Ayn Rand certainly advocated for that. The other flip side of that, which I mentioned earlier, is if there's a good candidate. Now, that is very rare. Now, for a while, Ayn Rand thought Wilkie was a good candidate, but realized he wasn't. The only other person that she really thought was a good candidate was Barry Goldwater in 1964. And, of course, Barry Goldwater was also mixed, and she landed up being quite disappointed in him. And landed up believing that he lost, partially because he had compromised and didn't stand up on principle, although one wonders whether the country was ready for somebody more principled. But Barry Goldwater lost in a landslide, but Ayn Rand definitely helped his campaign informally. She advocated for voting for him quite vigorously. She was, I don't think it was here so much an opponent of Johnson, although I'm sure she hated Johnson, but she was an advocate for Goldwater, which is unusual. The only two people I think she really advocated for with some passion, Wilkie, which she regretted completely, and Goldwater, which I don't think she ever regretted, although her passion was kind of, you know, went down over time. And somebody on the chat reminds me, I mean, there's a newsletter article by Ayn Rand from March 1964 titled How to Judge a Political Candidate, and it's excellent. You know, I have very little to add to that. So I'm just going to try to bring that up into the present, if you will. Although, let me say this. Those two cases, where it's clear-cut stopping evil, that's kind of obvious in my view. Last election, 2012, one had to vote against Obama. Obama was clearly taking the country in the wrong direction, was clearly evil, was clearly a statist, a collectivist, everything bad one can imagine. Obama, you know, that was Obama's presidency. And Mitt Romney was not very good. He was even pretty bad. But again, on the mixed economy premise, kind of on a Richard Nixon kind of standard, he was more on the free market side than on the not free market side overall when one takes into account who his opponent was. And I think it was important to vote against Obama in that election, just like it was against McGovern, just like it was against FDR. 2008 election, I think, was a little bit more complex. One, because McCain is such a statist, And McCain is such a bad, you know, was such a bad candidate in so many respects, but primarily because he was a statist. And because it wasn't quite clear, at least not to me, and I acknowledge I was mistaken. This is just more evidence to suggest that you shouldn't do everything that I tell you to do. You should use your own minds to make your own judgments. Not everything I say is right. I didn't realize how bad Obama was going to be. I thought Obama would swing to the center. I thought he was more about power than about ideology. I was wrong. Obama went to the left, and that's where he belongs, and that's where his heart is, and that's where his mind is, and he is a candidate off the left. Now, luckily for my conscience, I can say that since I vote in California, it doesn't really matter what I do. But some of you vote in Pennsylvania, and some of you vote in Florida, and some of you vote in Ohio, and even Nevada is in play this time. Maybe New Hampshire, maybe even Wisconsin. Who knows? And you don't get the benefit of being in California or New York, where your vote doesn't matter. Your votes might matter. In Florida in 2000, certainly individual votes clearly did matter. Okay, so we've got two scenarios where it's relatively easy. A candidate is so bad that he has to be defeated, and the person who is running against is not as bad. Right, is maybe not great, but is not horrible, not awful, not. Or the opposite, the other alternative is the candidate is good, basically good, you know, maybe not great, maybe certainly not perfect. One can't expect an objectivist candidate, but good, right? So then. One should vote for the good candidate if one really thinks this person is good. And we'll get to what goodness means in a little while and how to evaluate what is good and also how to evaluate what is so bad that one has to vote against something. We'll get to that in a little bit. But those are relatively easy elections to choose. The real difficulty is when both candidates are really, really, really bad. So both candidates are evil. And this is what Ayn Rand. This is what Ayn Rand wrote about the lesser of two evils. Here's what she wrote, and I'm quoting Ayn Rand: "You should vote only so long as you think a candidate has more virtues than flaws. But if you regard both candidates as evil, do not choose a lesser evil. Simply don't vote. For instance, I abstained in 1952 and 1956." I didn't vote for Eisenhower or Stevenson. Despite everything you hear to the contrary, abstaining, particularly by people who understand the issues, is a form of voting. You're choosing none of the above." End quote. So Rand would not vote for Eisenhower. Eisenhower. Right? Now I agree with Ayn Rand. Eisenhower was terrible. He was terrible. He was a New Dealer, basically, who did nothing but support the New Deal. In a sense, institutionalized it, and he was the first Republican to be elected after the New Deal was imposed, and he did nothing to unwind any of it. Quite the contrary, he basically solidified it as part of American culture, and in the name of Republicans, in the name of the right. So she understood this and therefore could not vote for him, even against Stevenson, who... Now, Stevenson was not a wacky, crazy, far-out, commie-loving leftist. He was just a run-of-the-mill leftist. So maybe if he had been a McGovern type, she would have voted for Eisenhower. But given that he wasn't a McGovern type, she would not vote for Eisenhower. So in the case, we have two evils, either both of them horrific, disastrous, going to take the country down, or both of them, you know, milquetoast, both of them going to be bad, but, you know, not horrific. How do you choose? How do you vote? And Ayn Rand's telling us that when both candidates have more flaws than virtues, you should stay out of it. You should not vote, right? So, you know, those are the kind of choices that we face. Really evil. Easy, vote against them. Really good, easy, vote for them. both pretty evil, different degrees of evil. How do you choose between them? How do you decide who to vote for? Right. And I believe, as you know, that that's the situation we are facing today. Okay. Call in. I'm sure you've got questions. I'm sure you've got comments. I'm sure you believe that one of these two candidates is so evil, he must be voted against. You can call in 347-324-3075, 347-324-3075. I'm sure we have far fewer listeners live today because of the odd hour that this is being played at. But if you're listening, 347-324-3075. And we've got our first caller. And hi, you're on the Yaron Brooks Show. Who's this?
Hi, this is Jennifer in Michigan. How are you?
Hey, Jennifer. How are you?
Fine.
Good.
I was just wondering, would it be like an irrational, emotional indulgence, like in this case, since they're both really bad,
yep,
to vote for one of them that I hate more, like Hillary, for example, just because I hate her so much and I would love to see her lose and her scumbucket husband, you know, because it would make her so mad to lose.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or would that just be stupid?
So you would vote for Trump just so Hillary would lose because you hate her so much?
Yeah, I mean, rather than not vote at all, which is what I was leaning toward up to now. But I just hate her so much. She's so evil. He's no good either, but I'm trying not to get too emotional about this.
I mean, I'm sympathetic to what you're saying, partially because if he wins, I mean, this is a few reasons to vote for Trump, but which I'm gonna talk about, but none of them is overwhelming, and none of them is big enough to cause me to embrace Trump, and I would never do that. But so nothing I'm gonna say today is actually gonna come down to a recommendation on how to vote. But let me sympathize with you, right? She is so despicable. She and her husband have been power lusting couple. He's already been president and disgraced the office of the president. She's even worse than him. And she just watching on television is just horrible.
I have to look away from her. Oh,
yeah. To think we're going to have to watch her for 4, maybe even, God forbid, 8 years is just such an emotionally draining thought. And then, of course, this is the thing that emotionally I would find most satisfying in Trump winning. It's that the whole establishment, all of the people, particularly on the left, would be so squirming and so pissed off and so depressed.
Too.
I mean, can you imagine election night will be so much fun watching all I'd watch MSNBC, right? Because what would they do? They'd spend a whole night blaming the American people and accusing them of being idiots and pathetic, and how pathetic Americans are. And it would be fun to watch them squirming. It's the thing I enjoyed most about Brexit. When Brexit happened, I really got pleasure out of watching the anti-Brexit vote. Just how could this happen? We are right, and we're superior, and we're so intelligent, and we're so we control the economy, and we control people's lives. How could they vote against what we wanted them to vote? That kind of the satisfaction that comes from watching your real enemy squirm is really enjoyable. You know,
just watch the unwashed people getting their way. It's like, oh, they can't stand that. Yeah, my husband's
but particularly when they were like elitists who think they're so smart and they're so smarter than everybody.
Those people getting what they want. They're like, oh, how dare those people do that? Ugh, you know.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. The little people beat them. The little people did it. And we who got degrees from the Ivy League, we're so much smarter than them. And how could we lose? That's horrible. So I would get immense emotional satisfaction from that. I get immense emotional satisfaction for watching Hillary Clinton give a speech about how she lost and having her force her to congratulate Donald Trump. That would be fun. However, my argument this morning is going to be not to be driven by emotion.
I know.
In spite of that, one has to be driven by reason. And now it could boil down to reason doesn't give me guidance here. There's just no way. And I'm going to go for the emotional high. Fine. But
yeah, because we're screwed either way, I'm figuring. What difference does it make? So you might as well have some
really
fun on the way down. That's what I was thinking.
But one really needs to think through who screws us more. And I'm not saying either one of them does, and I don't know. And it could be that what's going to be important is not to vote because, low turnout will say something. If there's a very high turnout, both parties will learn that these kind of candidates bring out people. There has to be some way to convey to the two main political parties that this is a pathetic choice, that they have to change the way they do their primaries, or they have to do something so that these kind of people, this quality of candidate, does not rise to the top. Now, I don't know if not voting achieves that, but I have to say that at the end of the day, in spite of all the emotional benefits I might get from this, I couldn't do it. I couldn't actually go into that booth and vote for somebody I considered evil or considered really, where, as Ayn Rand says, where the vices are greater than the virtues. So that's at the end of the day what you have to evaluate. Because at the end of the day, voting is a responsibility because you have to live with the consequences. If you vote for the winner, then whether your vote counted in a sense of it was the marginal vote or not, you are now morally responsible for the actions of the winner to some extent.
Yeah.
Right. So you have to live with that. So you have to live with the Trump presidency if you vote for Trump. And that might turn out to be okay, and it might turn out to be such a disaster. But I know how you're feeling, and I know, I mean, there's a strong emotional temptation. I mean, I'm also emotionally tempted to see Trump lose because this is the guy who is a winner. And just that arrogant stupidity that he has, he is such an idiot. I mean, I really do think the guy is an idiot. And I'm sorry, I know there are a lot of supporters of Trump out there. But after his performance in the debate, but just generally, the guy's not smart. He's just not smart. And maybe he was smart once. Maybe he has a high IQ. But he has no smarts. He has no capacity to think on his feet. He has no capacity to respond. He lost that debate by a big margin, and he didn't have to lose it. He got softballs.
Yeah, no, he let stuff go. Big stuff, yeah.
Huge softball. He could have knocked him out. He was completely unprepared. He really is an idiot. And, it would be cool to see an idiot who has no self-esteem, who declares himself a winner. It would be fun to watch him lose. So I wish that had happened in the Republican primaries. That would have been more fun because then we'd have a better at least candidate. So emotionally, it's difficult. I mean, so the emotional satisfaction of seeing the left squirm countered by the emotional disgust of watching Donald Trump with that stupid smile of his, that smirk, declare himself the winner. I don't know what I would do. I'd probably not watch television that night because I couldn't stand it. Or I'd watch NBC the whole time, MSNBC the whole time. The other thing is just to watch Hannity enjoy himself would be disgusting because I find Hannity. So emotionally, now that I think about it, you've evoked this in me. I'm not sure, emotionally, whether it would work.
Oh, what a mess.
What a mess. That's absolutely right. What a mess. And I suspect that my conclusion at the end of this mess, and I'm going to wait until the last minute to really make a decision. My conclusion at the end of this mess is I'm not going to vote for either one of them.
That's probably what I'm going to do too.
Yeah. And in California, it doesn't matter. So it really doesn't matter. But then at least I can live with it. I can live with whatever choice there is. All right. Really appreciate the call. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Sorry, I couldn't help.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right. We've got a few other callers, and you can join the conversation, 347-324-3075. We're talking about how to decide how to vote, how to make sense of all of this, how to evaluate candidates. And in a difficult situation, like I think we face this year, like I think we often face, but certainly this year. How do you decide? Is it, should you vote for the less of two evils? Is it okay not to vote? Is in this case one candidate significantly better than the other candidate? Is any candidate here have more virtues than vices? I don't know. 347-324-3075. All right, we've got another caller. Hi, you're on the Ron Book Show. Who's this?
Aloha, it's Stuart.
Aloha, Stuart. Well, what time is it in Hawaii?
It's 5 a.m. I've been burning the candle at both ends.
Okay. Hopefully productive time, not just sitting around waiting for the show.
Yeah. Well, I want to say I'm voting for Gary Johnson, and I think that doing so actually undermines the influence of the anarchists. It doesn't support them. I think it undermines them.
Why do you think that is?
Because in the libertarian movement, there's a culture clash where for a long time they've been controlled by Murray Rothbard's anarchist cronies. You know, now they're mostly at the Mises Institute, and they control Ron Paul. And they really, really hate what they call the Beltway Libertarians or the Koktopus, you know, the D.C. think tanks like Cato, Reason Foundation, Competitive Enterprise Institute. They don't like those guys because they think they're Milton Friedman-type, you know, Chicago School utilitarians, and worst of all, they're not anarchists. And
Well, some of them are, but they're not the kind of anarchists that Rothbard was. They're not philosophically subjectivists like Rothbard and the Mises people are. They are a different type of anarchists. So one day we'll do a whole show on anarchism because there's shades of anarchy as well in the anarchist movement.
Since 2012, we've been very threatened by Gary Johnson. When he first switched from Republican to Libertarian, the Rothbardian anarchists, like Roger Lee Wright's, mobilized against him. And they said, we have to protect our turf against the non-anarchists. And him getting the nomination was a big blow to the Rothbardians. And that's why Mises Institute is very hostile toward him. They're actually rooting for Trump, of all people.
Yeah, I know. What's his name? Walter Block started Libertarians for Trump. So many within the Mises are now Trumpians. And it fits because the Mises Institute is definitely driven by culturally xenophobia and anti-immigration and very much the kind of same kind of drivers that drive Trump and many, many kind of on the libertarian anarchist side. Are Trump supporters because they're not really for liberty. They support Trump for all the bad stuff he upholds. I know some objectivists who support Trump, but they say, oh, I disagree with him on immigration. I disagree with him about this. I disagree with him about that. No. These libertarians agree with him on all that crap, right? Trade and stuff like that. So, it's really amazing, but I'm not sure I agree with you, Stuart. And this is why, the Libertarian Party has nominated now for quite a few years candidates who are non-anarchist, really former Republicans. If you remember, Bob Barr from Atlanta, a former congressman, Bob Barr, was the nominee, I think, 6 years ago. Eight years ago. And, he's a Libertarian Republican / Republican type. He's certainly not an anarchist. I know Bob quite well. But you see, I still view it I still view this as them willing to tolerate within the Libertarian Party, the people who actually move and shake the Libertarian Party, not the Mises group. The Libertarian movement, it's not a movement because it's splintered so many different ways. I still think the leading voices in the Libertarian Party, and I might be wrong, but I still think the leading voices in the Libertarian Party are oriented towards anarchy, but they realize that if they put a real anarchist on, they'd get nothing. So they put on Bob Barr or Gary Johnson or people like that in order to gain credibility for the libertarian cause, and in the meantime, they hold all the reins, they hold all the controls. Now, I could be wrong, but that's my general sense of the party. I also think at the end of the day, And I said this in a interview with the Wall Street Journal that you can see online. If you go to the Wall Street Journal opinion page and look up Gary Johnson and maybe my name, you can find it, a short video. Gary Johnson's campaign is wasted. I mean, I would be more enthusiastic about Gary Johnson if he wasn't so milquetoast, right, that he wasn't, if he was a libertarian but had interesting ideas that were more libertarian, if he was willing to talk about entitlements, if he not just throw, if he, you know, when it comes to government spending, you know what his website says? We're going to cut waste and fraud, which is like the slogan of every Democrat and every Republican, every candidate in the history of mankind has wanted to cut waste and fraud. Here he is. He's not going to win anyway. He's got an opportunity to introduce really interesting ideas into the culture. He's got an opportunity to really shake up American politics and do something interesting. And he's nothing. He has no point of view. And it's just shocking to me. What a wasted opportunity. This should have been a campaign about educating the American public about what capitalism is about, what individual rights are about. And he once in a while says something about individual rights, but he's so weak and middle of the road when it comes to so many issues. I can't get excited about him. I don't even know that it's a protest vote, because what are we protesting for? He doesn't stand for much of anything.
Well, I have to say that in his op-eds, he has mentioned he wants to cut the budget by at least 20%.
Yeah, but he never says how. He says waste and fraud. So anybody who says I'm going to cut the budget and won't actually submit a list of the programs to be cut and a list of the criteria by which they're going to be cut is just demagoguing the issue. This is what they all do. They always do this. But again, he's not going to win. So what's he afraid of? Pissing off old people by saying he's going to cut Social Security? And why not hire Jose Piñera, who privatized Social Security in Chile, and have Jose Piñera present an American version and say, here, I'm running on privatizing Social Security. I'm running on a voucher system for Medicare. And this is how we're going to cut the cost. And this is what we're going to do. I mean, Paul Ryan is more radical than Gary Johnson when it comes to some of these issues. And it's so disappointing, because I actually thought that and I like Gary Johnson. He's kind of a nice guy. I've met him. He's a nice guy. He's certainly not an anarchist. I don't think he has any sympathies with that side. But come on, you got a real opportunity here. You know, stand for something. And I just can't get it. You know, Weld is more articulate than him. And we know Weld is just a moderate Republican. That's how he governed. Massachusetts. So he was the governor of Massachusetts. So we've got basically what we've got here is a pair of moderate Republicans, middle of the road. On social issues, they're fairly liberal. And on fiscal issues and economic issues, they're fairly on the right, conservative. But there's nothing radical, interesting, nothing here that this would be, wow. People voted, 7, 8, 9% of the population voted to privatize Social Security. Wow, that's cool. Now, that would be important. So if he had a program there, then maybe I could overlook the idea that the Libertarian Party is really kind of using him to make inroads into the popular culture while they are really still the anarchists that they are. But maybe I could overlook that, because he would stand for something that then would be a counter to the prevailing political, direction. But he doesn't. He stands for nothing.
So well, I mean, do you make a distinction between the Libertarian Party and, say, the Cato Institute? Because, I mean, when people say, well, the Cato Institute presents this more mainstream front,
sure.
But it's really
sure.
trying
so
to make
yeah,
a Trojan
Cato,
horse for anarchy.
But Cato, once in a while, I don't consider Cato as a Trojan horse, although I do consider the potential that Gary Johnson is. But again, if Gary Johnson stood for something, if he actually advocated passionately for radical ideas, for radical free market ideas, for a different approach to government, if he came out and said, I believe the only role of government is to protect individual rights, and I know I won't be able to implement all this when I'm president, but I believe in that. That's how I will evaluate every program, and I'm going to cut government based on this principle. I would be far, far more inclined to vote for him, because then I'd say, okay, this is a vote for something in opposition to the two parties. But if he comes out and says, I'm more free market than Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, I'm going to cut spending 20%. I'm not going to tell you how. And I'm for you know, I believe that the Earth is warming because of man-made stuff. But and maybe I'll impose credit, carbon credit. Oh no, I won't impose carbon credit. I mean, it's just you're not voting for anything. You're not voting for a coherent alternative that the electorate and the intellectuals will say, okay, wow, people voted for individual rights. People voted for privatizing Social Security. People voting for a pro-capitalist candidate. Maybe we should pay attention to that. You see, that's what this campaign should be about. It should be about giving voice to whatever pro-capitalist elements there are in the culture today. And he doesn't. So what all the vote for him means is I didn't want to vote for Hillary and Trump because he really doesn't stand for that much. And you can just not vote and achieve the same thing.
Well,
I wish I could love Gary Johnson. I really wish.
Well, I think it's very important to take the stand against the alt-right because Donald Trump is the candidate of the alt-right. And I think if he – they will be the new threat to freedom in the next
I agree with you.
At least
I
10
agree
years.
With you. I agree with you. And to that
so
extent,
hostile toward him.
I agree with you. And to that extent, I think we should – I think people should consider – I'm not saying voting this way, but I think you have to consider. It has to be on your radar when you're analyzing this to vote for Hillary because I agree with you about the risk of the alt-right, and I agree with you about what Donald Trump represents. Now, I'm not saying vote for Hillary. I'm just saying you can't rule that out. Because I do think Donald Trump is a real threat, and I think the alt-right is very, very, very dangerous direction that this country will go in. It's like Ayn Rand didn't vote for Reagan because she was afraid he would bring the moral majority and the religious right into the Republican Party, and she was absolutely right. And if you think that the alt-right is a real force, a potentially real force in American culture and in the American right, then voting for Donald Trump and allowing that to come in to dominate the Republican Party would be the end of liberty forever. So one has to make an evaluation about how – but you see, Gary Johnson's not going to change all that because Donald Trump will win or lose. And Hillary – the battle's between Hillary and Donald Trump. That's the battle. And a vote for Gary Johnson doesn't affect that battle really. It's just like not voting again. All right.
But I think that, you know, he does strike a blow against the anarchists. And, you know, I think his problem is that he's a Milton Friedman-type utilitarian. And I think that's an improvement over the anarchists because, you know, when you talk to people or like that.
I agree
like
with
him,
you. And if he – I agree with you. And if he made half the arguments Milton Friedman made, if he'd stand up for half the things Milton Friedman stood up for, I would vote for him. But he doesn't. He's a milquetoast Milton Friedman, which is worse than anything. It's just not interesting. It's just it will have no impact on the world. If he was Milton Friedman, in spite of all my reservations about Milton Friedman, in spite of all Ayn Rand's reservations about Milton Friedman, I would vote for Milton Friedman right now without any question. But Gary Johnson ain't no Milton Friedman, and he doesn't represent that because he's not willing to push the envelope on economic issues. He's not willing to be even a libertarian on economic issues. He's nothing. He doesn't really stand for anything. And that's what upsets me. And second, I do believe strongly that he does not represent the Libertarian Party. The Libertarian Party is not Gary Johnson. Gary Johnson is a candidate, just like Bob Barr was, that they put forward because they know they can't run as an anarchist, but that the core, the party officials, the party, you know, the party decision makers are the real bad guys within the libertarian movement. Now, I might be wrong there. I might be wrong, but it doesn't really matter because, again, Gary Johnson doesn't really stand for much. And if he did, I'd be willing to really research the Libertarian Party, really figure out what they stand for, really figure out what a vote for Gary Johnson would mean. But in this case, it's too boring to vote for. If he had one interesting radical policy position that he ran on, I would be open to changing my mind. But he hasn't. He's trying to get Bernie voters, and he's doing that by appealing to the left. And he's moderated every one of his positions.
Well,
And he's trying to get moderate Republicans. And he's trying to get moderate Republicans. You know, but he's not a free market guy.
He's the only one standing up for immigrants and Mexicans. And I'm very concerned about how the anti-Mexican element has completely taken over the right.
I agree with you. I agree with that. But it's just not strong enough, and it's not a big enough deal. And again, he's not going to win. So it's a question of where's your protest vote best spent on if you decide it's a protest vote on Hillary, on not on Hillary, on not voting on Gary Johnson. And I think because of the risk that the Libertarian Party as a party is still in the hands of the anarchists, and because he is just not that good, I just don't think that's the best protest vote to make. I just can't get excited about it, and I can't really advocate for it. But I understand you wanting to vote for it, and I can't say, don't vote for Gary Johnson. Nobody out there, don't vote for Gary Johnson. I can't for the reasons I just gave, and I certainly can't, and I've said this before. What I do in the voting booth, who knows? But I can't advocate for it any more than I can advocate for voting for one of these big, one of these top candidates. Not partially because I run a 501c3 and I'm not supposed to advocate for it, but partially because I really can't advocate for it because he's just not strong on anything. And if he was strong on immigration, if he had a real immigration plan, a real something, and he was making a big deal out of it, he was the immigration candidate and he was out there defending immigrants with a real plan on a consistent active basis. Again, my opinion, but he's like, yeah, I'm for immigrants, but it's not – there's no drive to this campaign. So a vote for him doesn't represent anything specifically because he doesn't stand for anything specifically. Anyway, really appreciate the call, Stuart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for calling in, and thanks for getting up so early to listen. Aloha.
Mahalo.
Mahalo. Mahalo. All right, we got one more call, and you can call in if you want in on the conversation. If you, you know, I'd love to hear from somebody who's going to vote for Hillary. How about that? Somebody who's going to. We've heard from people who are voting for Trump. I wonder if there's anybody out there who would actually who would dare vote in who's voting for Hillary. That would be interesting. All right, we've got one more caller, and usually on my screen it shows me the number for you guys to call. Now, remember, if you call, you've got to press, I think, 1 so that I can see that you want to ask a question versus just listening into the show while on the phone. So I've got a number of people who are called in but don't have the little question mark symbolizing to me that you want to ask a question, and therefore I'm not going to go to you. So there's somebody from 773 area code, 484 area code, 706 area code. If you want to ask a question, press, I think it's 1. So that I know that you want to ask a question. Okay, we've got a 906 area call, code caller. Hi, you're on the Yaron Book Show. Who's this?
Hi, Yaron. This is Mark from Michigan.
Hey, Mark. How are you? We've got a couple of Michigan callers. This is cool.
Yes, I actually don't know the first caller, so maybe she should join the Great Lakes Objectivist so we can
there you go. There's a Great Lakes Objectivist group. Join it.
Yeah. So right. Anyway, I wanted to basically – echo some of the points that Stuart just made, but not rehash them all with you. But when you in the pro Johnson vein, so when you say that Gary Johnson doesn't stand for anything, I agree that he doesn't stand for radical capitalism, but I think he stands for something different, which is still significant. I think he stands for what Walter Olson, the Cato lawyer, he's calling libertarian centrism, where you can. He's trying to mainstream this idea where you can have like vaguely pro-business, anti-tax views and not be a religious nut job or an anti-immigrant nativist. He's trying to bring together the forces in the culture that can support that kind of constellation of views. And when you compare it to past libertarian movements, it's interesting. We've got Gary Johnson. Let's say he has 7% of the voting population that supports him. And like you said, that's without the Rothbard types supporting him. So this represents that we've got this chunk of people who can support views which I think are definitely better than Trump and Clinton. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I agree with you that they're better than Trump and Clinton, and I agree with you that 7% is pretty good, although I think the 7% is driven by the fact that it's Trump and Clinton. That is, I don't think you would get 7% if there was a decent Republican or even a decent Democrat if that were running, I don't think you'd get 7%. I don't think even if Bernie was running, I think some of the people voting for Gary Johnson were Bernie supporters, and I would be surprised if Bernie was running that you would get less than 7%. So I'm just not convinced, but I still would go back to this. Okay, so what you're looking for is a coalition of people who are relatively pro-free markets and not religious, and I guess that's it, and socially kind of liberal. Well, great.
Yeah.
Then I would start a new party, because that's not what libertarianism is or stands for or should represent. It's not free markets, because it's just moderate. It's nothing, as I said before, it's nothing here. It's neither here nor there. And get away then from the libertarian label. Get away from the control that I still think the anarchists have on the Libertarian Party, and start a centrist party, a third wave. There have been plenty of attempts in the past. I actually think if you did that, if you really declared, we're not laissez-faire, we're not religious, we're not socialist, we're kind of middle of the road, we're what Republicans used to be, or Democrats used to be a long, long time ago, and you would get 20% of the vote. I think you would get a lot better than 7% of the vote. I think what's hampering the Gary Johnsons of the world is the fact that he is in a libertarian party. So he gets torn in different directions, and it's not clear. You can't put him anywhere. You can't place him anywhere, because it's not clear what he's trying to do. He's one day is courting the left, another day is courting the right. He never has articulated a position, a real position of where he stands. So I actually think that piece of the electorate, what people call economically conservative and socially liberal, but I think those are bad terms, but use the conventional terminology. That piece of the electorate is probably more than 20%. And I think if you had a candidate in one of the main parties that represented that, I think he would win in a landslide right now. But I think the primary season does not allow one to choose candidates like that, because the right pushes them towards the religion, the left pushes them towards being socialists, and you get candidates that are just awful, like we have right now. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I have nothing really that much against Gary Johnson, except that he's milquetoast. I mean, it's just what an opportunity he has. What a waste of a candidate. I mean, imagine if there was somebody who had a little bit of charisma and who was willing to take on the establishment and really articulate a case for immigration and really articulate a case for privatizing entitlements and really articulate a case, not even laissez-faire, but just articulate a case for beginning the privatization of these things, a case for government subsidies. Why doesn't Gary Johnson come out and say, under a Gary Johnson administration, there will be no subsidies, no government subsidies to any business whatsoever, ever, anywhere. No bailouts, no subsidies, and we'll reduce regulations at the same time. That's simple. Simple. Or a zero corporate income tax, which is a sales tax on everybody else. Use this to educate people. I mean, if I were running Gary Johnson's campaign, or if I were Gary Johnson, I could get 20% of the vote and advocate for a radical solution for real problems. It would be fun, too. But I'm not the candidate, so it sucks.
Okay. I agree with a lot of what you just said about Gary Johnson. I think he could do better with the centrist coalition. He's not as articulate as you are, or as
My coalition wouldn't be centrist. My coalition would be in the third dimension. It would be neither right nor left, and I think it exists out there. And I think, and at the very least, I think even though you would lose, you would be setting the future up. That is, by presenting a coherent, interesting, radical, pro-capitalist, pro-freedom, pro-individual rights alternative, even if you got 5%, 6%, 7%, there'd be a standard now. There'd be something people could look at and say, some people would say, that's where we need to head to. That's the standard. That's where we should fight for. There'd be something to rally around. One of the depressing things about the current political environment is What are you going to rally around? It's all boring. It's all stupid. It's all anti-individual rights. It's all there's nothing exciting. There's nothing to really get the vote out or to think in 8 years this is where I want to be, because there's no standard bearer. There's no standard by which to evaluate what to do. So what an opportunity he has. I really think this is an historic opportunity Gary Johnson had because of how bad the two candidates are. It's a moment in history where a candidate who was strong, articulate, and with a message couldn't have won, but could have changed the dynamics of elections in America forever, because he could have actually changed the way people think about government, changed the way people think about what's possible. You know, and that's not going to happen. I'll give you an example. One more example. Ross Perot changed the way Americans thought and had a profound impact on thinking because he had one clear, simple message. And that was, and if some of you remember this because you're old enough to remember this, he went on television, this boring little guy, and he basically flipped charts to the American people in very coherent terms. The deficit spending, the debt, was a bad thing, and it was terrible, and it was going to destroy the country, and it was immoral because it was going to lays all this debt on our children and grandchildren and steals the money from the people today. And it's just, it was a bad thing. That's all he said. Debt is bad. And you know what happened? He didn't win, but he won so many votes that Bill Clinton had to pay attention. So even though Bill Clinton won in 92 and then again in 96, Bill Clinton was one of the best Democrats ever when it comes to government spending. He actually shrunk the deficit, and he left office with a balanced budget. Because and as a percent of GDP, government spending actually went down, which you can't say for Reagan, and you certainly can't say for Bush. And it's because Ross Perot pushed the debate in a particular direction. And even though he lost, the president had to pay attention. Gary Johnson had that opportunity. Take one issue, take three issues, and bombard the American people with those issues and take a principled, radical stand on them. Social Security is a good example. And then you would force whoever got elected to have to deal with the fact that 15-20% of Americans voted for you. And therefore, they'd have to deal with that issue somehow. So my main thing about Gary Johnson is, what a missed opportunity. Oh, my God. He really, really, really could have changed the debate in this country, and he's not going to. All right.
Okay.
and that's not to say you shouldn't vote for him, but you know, I think it's a missed. My main point is a missed opportunity. Thanks for calling. Thanks for listening. Hope you keep on listening. All right, we've got one more caller from the 773 area code. Hi, you're on the Yaron Brooks Show. Who's this?
Hi, this is Cherie from Chicago.
Hi, Cherie. How are you?
I'm good, and you?
I'm good. It's a
depressing calm down
topic,
a little bit.
I'm a little depressed.
It is depressing, and I was just wanted to reiterate what you said about Gary Johnson. I'm going to be abstaining. I just think I know a lot of people who want to vote for Gary Johnson, and I understand it, but just like you were saying, the guy is – I kind of see him as a little bit of a weenie. You know, he's kind of just – 60 Minutes had a couple of weeks ago, 60 Minutes, Steve Croft actually interviewed him, and I thought, well, let me see what this guy's got to say. And he absolutely had nothing to say. And I just thought, what a joke. What a waste
and
of time.
And what an opportunity. You've got 60 Minutes there. You've got their attention. People are interested because they're looking for an alternative. Say something. And, you know, was that the interview where he couldn't name, he didn't know what Aleppo is, or then he couldn't name a foreign leader?
They actually did a segment on that, but it was pretty much just about Gary Johnson, about who he is. And you know how 60 Minutes is sometimes. They're very they're not always good with these, especially with someone who's trying to fight the establishment, the quote-unquote establishment. Yeah. But I just saw him as a dull. I mean, and he pretty much highlighted to me the inherent problems with the libertarian movement. I mean, you got a little dash of this idea, a little dash of that idea, sprinkle it all in and see what you get. And he just came off as pretty much useless. So, I mean, I was listening to Stewart, whom I like. I like his website and everything, but he is wasting his vote. It's a wasted vote.
Yep.
In my opinion.
I agree, because I don't think it sends the kind of message that I think those voting for him want to send. I agree with the message they want to send. They want to send a message that here are better ideas and that the two candidates are despicable and they can't vote for them. Unfortunately, I don't think it sends that message. I wish it did. Great.
Yeah,
well,
and the thing with – well, yeah, I'll go ahead. I'll leave.
Go ahead. No, that's fine. That's fine. Go ahead.
Well, during the interview, they tried to show himself as being very laid back and, you know, not so stage managed as you see with Clinton and with Trump to a certain extent. And that's a positive, but you have to have some juice to it, you know. And it was unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, this is the guy who in the first debate he did, I guess, on television with John Stossel, said he had just smoked pot and was a little high during the debate. Really? And this is what I mean. It's tacky. It's stupid. It's irresponsible. It's, you know, is he going to smoke pot before he makes decisions about whether to go to war or not or anything like that?
Right.
I mean, it's that libertarian anarchist. I don't care about the world. It's just so stupid. And again, what an opportunity the guy had. What an opportunity this was to do something significant, and what a waste.
It is a waste.
This laid back attitude suggests he's on pot rather than I want intensity. I don't want laid back. I want somebody who's intense, who's dedicated, who's passionate. I don't want somebody rehearsed necessarily like Hillary is. But I want to see them taking this seriously and with passion and really have an agenda. And I just don't see that one we just said.
Yeah. Well,
great.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for calling.
Keep up the good work.
Thanks for listening. Good talking to you, Cherise. All right. If you want to call in, you can still call in. I saw somebody called in and went away, but just remember to press 1 when you're dialed in. All right. I need a short break. So we're going to take a short break with, I think, some new commercials, and then we'll be right back after this.
The Money Changers, the documentary film about banking that God and Washington don't want you to see. In this feature-length documentary, team up with Shylock to examine the evolution, viability, and morality of America's financial system. Stay after the screening and you'll have a chance to participate in a live Q&A with director Chris Mortensen and ARI's Yaron Brook. Screenings are in select theaters. Get tickets at moneychangersfilm.com.
Free speech is under attack. Islamic totalitarians repeatedly threaten and kill those who offend them, while our leaders appease the attackers and blame the victims. College students seek trigger warnings and safe spaces to protect them from controversial ideas. The government harasses Tea Party groups for their political speech, and it investigates oil companies and advocacy groups for dissenting from climate change orthodoxy. Why is this happening? What can be done? Find answers in ARI's new book, Defending Free Speech, by me, Steve Simpson. Order it today on Amazon.
Join the 40,000 subscribers already connecting with ARI through our newsletter, Impact Weekly. You'll learn about our programs and discover our distinct perspective on today's most talked about issues. Whether you're a student interested in getting updates on ARI's essay contests, an Ayn Rand fan looking for ARI events in your area, or if you're simply looking to learn more about ARI's activities around the country and what we're doing to advance freedom, Impact Weekly is your go-to source for these and other timely updates. Visit AynRand.org/signup today.
15 years off to September 11th, Islamic totalitarianism is undefeated and on the march from Paris and San Bernardino to Brussels and Orlando. Our military strength is unmatched, and yet Islamic totalitarianism is still a menace. Why? ARI's new book, Failing to Confront Islamic Totalitarianism, From George W. Bush to Barack Obama and Beyond, addresses this very question and the fundamental problem at its core. The book, a collection of essays from ARI experts Ankar Gatte and me, Ilan Jerno, highlights the irrational philosophic ideas that permeate and subvert American foreign policy. While the United States is indeed a military superpower, it lacks the moral certainty needed to defend itself and its ideals, and our political intellectual leaders evade the true nature of Islamic totalitarianism. After 9/11, ARI predicted that the prevailing ideas about morality would undercut our foreign policy, ultimately crippling us. Sadly, those predictions have proven to be correct. We can end the Islamist menace and secure our right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, easily in fact, but we must adopt the right philosophic ideas to guide the way. Pick up your copy of Failing to Confront Islamic Totalitarianism at Amazon today to learn more about this life or death issue.
For 30 years, the Ayn Rand Institute has been on the front lines of the culture wars, introducing millions of students to Ayn Rand's books and ideas, educating young intellectuals who now teach at universities around the world, and speaking out in defense of free speech, free markets, free minds. You can join their battle for reason, individualism, and capitalism here and around the nation by making your contribution today at AynRand.org/support. That's AYNRAND.org/SUPPORT.
Yeah, guys, go make a contribution, because where else are you going to hear this kind of commentary? Nowhere else. Nowhere else online, nowhere else on the radio, nowhere else are you going to hear my voice, my ideas. It's unique, it's special, and it's better than anybody else, right? So support the show. Don't be a free rider. Go to ari.aynrand.org/support and make a contribution, $25, $50, $100, $1,000,000. You can do something. I have no doubt you can do something. It's October 1st. It's actually the first day of our new fiscal year at ARI. So help us start off the year with a bang. Go now, aynrand.org/support, and you can use PayPal, Bitcoin, credit cards, monthly contributions out of your checking account. Any way you want, you can help support the Ayn Rand Institute. So please do that. All right, so I want to get back to some principles on how to look at the campaigns. And then we've got one more caller, and I'll take that call. It's an 845 area code, so that's you. I'll take your call in a few minutes. One has to, in voting, one has to think, I think, that the primary way to think about it is what is going to actually advance the cause of individual rights? What's actually going to advance the cause of capitalism, freedom, America? And who is the bigger, who is going to advance the cause of statism? And statism here is a broad term. So it's not just about economic freedom. It's about trade policy, immigration policy. Trade is economic, but immigration policy is an issue here, and how you fall in an immigration issue is going to determine, I'm sure, your approach to this election. But it's also about your views on abortion, your views on free speech, your views on gay marriage, your views on a lot of social issues that are just as important from the context of freedom, at least to some Americans, but overall to the case for freedom, as is whether you're going to raise or lower taxes. And of course, it's interesting that nobody in this campaign, including Gary Johnson, unfortunately, is really talking about spending, is really talking about programs on how to cut spending. So the lower taxes is just nonsense, given that all that'll do is blow up deficits. And then what? And then you have to borrow more. And that has almost as many, or maybe even more, depending on the economic conditions, negative consequences in the economy as taxes do. So one has to look at the entire portfolio of a candidate. But it's not like, and I said this during the primaries, it's not like you make a whole list of all the issues and checkmark the ones that are reasonable and the ones that are awful, and then you add up the checkmarks. You have to look in principle. Is this candidate, in the way he's going to govern, in the way he or she make decisions, are they going to move us to statism faster or slower? And so, for example, I know some of you think the most important issue of our time is immigration, that immigrants are destroying the country, that immigrants are going to cause this country to swing rapidly to the left, and therefore the number one issue for you is immigration. And I'm not going to argue against that right now, but let's say you believe that, then you can't vote for somebody who is not tough on immigration, because you believe that that is the issue that determines, no matter what everything else is, that's the thing that determines. Or like Stuart mentioned, if you believe that the alt-right is very powerful. This is the alternative right. I'm going to do a show on the alt-right. I still got some research to do, and I haven't made up my mind about how powerful they really are and how significant they really are and how much of a movement they are versus a collection of miscellaneous stuff. But that's going to be a show in the future soon. But if you believe that the alt-right is a real threat like Stuart does, and like I suspect I do too, and when I do the research, I'll probably agree with Stuart, then you cannot – then that is such a threat, because they are – the alt-right, based on Stuart's research, and I think I agree with him, is authoritarian, racist, anti-American in such a fundamental sense and such a danger to taking over the Republican Party that you would never, ever vote for a candidate who brought that in. And this is why Ayn Rand wouldn't vote for Reagan. If you just did the checklist, Reagan would win out because he was more on her side on more issues than the other side, right? Because he was pro deregulation and lower taxes and stuff like that. And he said he would cut spending, although he never did. He was anti-communism. It's interesting, though, what she said about the communism, about Reagan and communism. I don't know if you guys know what she said was she objected to Reagan's approach to communism because she thought Reagan gave too much credit to the Soviet Union. She thought that Reagan's whole approach to the Soviet Union emboldened them and empowered them in the sense that he thought they were real danger, and her approach to the Soviet Union were they're incompetent, evil bastards. You know, they're not a risk to the country. They're not a threat to the country. Ignore them. Don't trade with them. Don't have anything to do with them, nothing to do with them, but don't build up the military because of the Soviet threat. There was no Soviet threat in her view. Now, you can agree or disagree, but that was interesting how Ayn Rand at these issues, viewed these issues, right? So it's, you know, so you have to figure out what do you believe by reason. What do you believe are the key issues, are the most important issues? And then try to figure out, is either one of these countries, either one of these candidates so bad that you can't vote for them because they embolden these fundamental ideas that are so antagonistic to freedom that one can never vote for them. Hillary, for example, I think will swing to the left. I think she's going to play up Elizabeth Warren. I think Elizabeth Warren will be a real force in a Clinton administration. I think that means that she is going to be destructive to the economy, destructive to free speech, destructive to individual rights. I think it's unthinkable to vote for Hillary. On the other hand, you know, if you look at Donald Trump, I think Stuart's right. I think he is right. If he were president, he would embolden the worst elements in this country, the worst kind of xenophobia, anti-trade, racist elements within the American public. He would bring them in to the Republican Party and make them a part of it, not because he is necessarily any of that, but because he represents that to so many people, and he is tolerant of that over and over and over again. And then on top of that, I also think that his trade policy is just so dangerous economically. It's devastating economically that I can't vote for him either. So then, and I've just told you about Gary Johnson. So, but you have to decide using reason, what are the issues for you that make the most difference? And too many of you, in my view, are caught up in emotion. And too many of you are caught up in unsubstantiated claims by both the left and the right media about what's going on in the world right now. And you're not doing research, or if you want to take this election seriously, do research into these positions, do research into these candidates, and look objectively at the facts, not rumors. With Donald Trump, just one other thing, because he's been tweeting in the middle of the night recently, do you really want a president who gets up at 3 in the morning and attacks a Miss Universe? Who cares what she stands for? Who cares what she's done? Really? This is the level that a president of the United States goes to? All right, we've got two calls now. We're going to take them quickly because I don't have a lot of time, but let's take them. Hi, you're on the Ron Brooks Show. Who's this?
Uh, this is Howard, New York.
Hey, Howard, how are you?
Very well, Yaron. We met briefly one time when you were speaking with Pamela Geller.
Okay, yes, I remember.
I think if you saw me, you would know who I was. I've seen you several times in person.
Good.
My large concern is that I'm an objectivist, but I'm of Jewish descent. And there's equal amounts, and this is not only this would be in principle of any race, but
sure.
The anti-Semitism of the alt-right, you know, is a concern for me. But so is the anti-Semitism of the left on college campuses.
I agree.
There's this terrible stream from both sides, which kind of conflates itself in the Walt Mearsheimer type of thinking. I mean, these two things have blended together in a terrible, terrible way. And this is a terrible synthesis of ideas from that the alt-right got a lot of this from the left.
Yep.
Okay.
Well,
so
I think you're right.
Or at least get some sanction from it. I mean, you see some libertarians who actually quote Chomsky.
I know. The whole political map today has been thoroughly corrupted. It's awful. It's depressing. I can't think of a worst. I think this is the worst election in American history by far. All the worst elements in our culture, the worst of the worst of the elements of the American people, are out for this election. Up front and center in this election. You're right. The left is anti-Semitic, just to take the anti-Semitic issue, right? The left is anti-Semitic, and to some extent, I've got an article about a talk about anti-Semitic anti-capitalism. Those who are anti-capitalist have always been anti-Semitic, and the left is an example of that. But now you've got the alt-right, which is racist and anti-Semitic, and you've got the libertarian anti-Semitic wing that quotes Noam Chomsky and hates Israel. And it's like, where do you go? And it really, really is depressing and really, really is scary. And I have to say, I think I can't vote because of all of this. And if you analyze it and you look at it, there's just nobody, there's nobody you can really get behind. There's nobody who you can really get excited about. You can tolerate. Now, again, Johnson is tolerable, but I fear that the Libertarian Party he stands, he represents, is not.
Right.
So what are you going to do, Howard?
The best that I could come up with right now, and I'm trying to parse this out, and I talked to my wife about it this morning, and I try to test it against her thinking, and this is what my line of reasoning is right now. And I'm not saying that I'm right about this by any stretch, because this is a very, very difficult thing for me to parse out. But a vote for Hillary does not make the alt-right go away.
Nope.
Okay? And Trump is slightly better on the Second Amendment, and maybe somebody would challenge that. So at least there, and I don't know which opponent I might face. I don't know which guy I might be facing. I don't know if it's going to be some skinhead or some left-wing guy who hates me because of how I look or for whatever reason. So what I'm thinking
is you're so worried about the country that you believe a better Second Amendment candidate. Yeah. So you're so worried about the country that you believe that you're going to need weapons to defend yourselves against the rise of anti-Semitism. So you're going to vote on the weapons issue, and that's going to be the driver of your vote.
If my life and my precious life and the life of my wife and children
is my standard of value. I can't argue against that. I mean, that if you really think that we're there, that we're at the point where we're in the cusp of violence, either from the left or from the alt-right, that's true. I do fear, again, that if Trump gets elected and the alt-right is what you say they are, and I think you're right, then they get institutionalized. And institutionalized violence against you is something your handgun, your shotgun is not going to help. And 20 years down the road, I don't think it'll happen in the next 8 years, but 20 years down the road, when you know, the brown shirts are marching, and I hate to be dramatic here, and I hate to make this,
because I don't
necessarily think this is going to happen, but it could, then that vote in 2016 might have been the vote that, that laid the path to that. And that's what scares me. And that's why I say I can't figure this. I don't think there's a way to figure this out. I really believe this is a case, as Ayn Rand said, where the two candidates are so evil that one cannot vote for either one of them.
Right. My concern is that I would make that choice, and then many years later that comes down the pike. But then again, you can also
and you don't
see
have a gun to protect yourself.
Then I would rather take my chances because I think it's going to happen sooner than later, maybe even from the left.
I get it. I mean, we're not going to argue because I understand what you're saying completely, and I sympathize. And I'm not going to tell you guys how to vote. You're each going to have to decide on the issue. And this is what's so awful about the election, that these kind of issues that Howard's articulating, these kind of issues, this is America. This is America. Who would have ever believed that we would even have a conversation like this in America?
Right.
I mean, it's just depressing.
When we see the degree of – oh, you have to take a next call.
I do have to take another call, and I've only got 9 minutes. So, sorry. Call again. We'll keep talking about this stuff, but I really appreciate it. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much.
Thanks
for
listening to the show. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Hi, you're on the Yvonne Book Show. Who's this?
Hi, this is Elizabeth calling from Ottawa, Canada.
Hey, Elizabeth. How are you? Oh, Canadian. All right. You've got Trudeau. You don't have to worry about an election. You've already chosen badly.
Oh God! Well, that wasn't my choice. So that's sort of why I'm calling. And feel free to stop me if this isn't relevant enough to what you're doing on the show today. But I've always regarded voting in Canadian elections as not being that important. And I've either not voted because I think it doesn't matter as much as the states, and everybody's a cynical pragmatist up here anyway. Or I've voted on a single issue, but not a principled issue that I care about, something like deregulating the dairy industry. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on whether it is important to vote in other countries, including Canada, and how you should choose on that.
I mean, I definitely think so, because there are big issues. I mean, your healthcare system is a big issue. Trudeau is going to, in a sense, the Canadian national healthcare system has been emboldened by and it's been solidified by his election. I think that
it's been solidified for so many decades that's impossible.
But there was discussion about privatizing elements of it. There was discussion about letting the provinces have more say. So these would have been minor, but they could be significant. So I do think that in every country you have to decide what are the big issues. And I don't know enough about Canadian politics to know, but my sense was that there was starting to be some opposition. There was starting to be some talk of alternatives, and that kind of disappeared with Trudeau's election. And I would have supported anything that would have encouraged those kind of. And I agree with you, like on dairy issues or small or minor issues like that, or seemingly minor issues, you should vote. But I think that the general principle is the same. Vote for the candidate, unless both are clearly evil and bad. Vote for the candidate who is going to lead us away from statism versus the candidate who's going to lead us towards more statism. And if there is such
difficult.
A candidate in Canadian election, vote for them.
It's really difficult outside of the U.S. because, you know, people in the U.S. are the most, outlandish as this may seem to the U.S. listeners, the U.S. has the most principled ideological thinkers in the world. That doesn't really
exist. You couldn't tell today.
Yeah, but it's even worse elsewhere.
I think that's right.
There just aren't people who think on principles in a country like Canada.
Yeah, but I think that's right. And so you're never going to get a principled guy. It's just a question, and Ayn Rand mentions this, in a mixed economy, who is given that mixture more on the side of freedom and less on the side of statism? That's the best that you can do. And I think, for example, in the UK election, I would never vote for Jeremy Corbyn because he's so bad. He's so evil. He's such a socialist that I'd vote for the Conservatives even though they're kind of milquetoast. But on the spectrum, they are going to bring in policies that are slightly better for freedom than a Jeremy Corbyn. I think in Canada, Trudeau is so much of a socialist and so likely to push the Canada, I would have probably voted against him. But, you know, I don't know enough about Canadian policy to judge it. Look, if you're looking for principle, you can't vote anyway because the Americans, even the best among them, have no principles. So you've
right.
got to vote for the not for the less of two evils, but for if there is a decent candidate, somebody who at least is on the right side of a few issues.
I think one positive yeah. thing you can say about Americans in terms of principles is that at least often political candidates feel that they have to appeal to voters
I think
who
that's
have.
Right.
Yeah,
I think
whereas
that's, right.
that's not the case
yeah.
in Canada.
No, you're right. You're right. But you have to think the politicians have an influence over your life, and you want to be able to take a stand, even if it's a small stand by voting, against those who inflict the most damage on you. That's mm-hmm. the best I can come up with.
Yeah,
but, you know,
it's not great, but I guess it'll have to do.
No. Anyway, I've got 4 minutes. Thanks for calling. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening. And just a reminder to go to AORI.org and click the donate button and support this radio show and support what we do at the Institute. Look, it is very depressing. There is no easy answer here. I'm not going to tell you who to vote for. I'm probably going to tell you I'm not going to vote. Now, I will say this. I think in this election, it's really, really important we go out and vote. And it's really, really important that we vote for House and Senate and we vote for Republicans. We vote against the Democrats because both Hillary and Donald Trump are leftist when it comes to economic policy. And you've got to have somebody in the House and Senate who will stand up to them. So you've got to have somebody who will stand up to Donald Trump on trade. You've got to have somebody who will stand up to Hillary Clinton on taxes and regulations. You've got to have somebody who looks over their shoulders and monitors what they do, both of them. Whoever gets elected, we're going to need a relatively robust Senate and a robust House who will look over these guys' shoulders and see. So I would definitely go out and vote. Vote, you know, in national politics, vote other than the president, vote Republican for Senate, Republican for House, no matter how bad they might be, just as a counterbalance to whoever gets into power as president. We need Republicans. Republicans are pretty good opposition parties sometimes. At least they create stalemate, or gridlock, which is a good thing. And they might create gridlock with Donald Trump as well. They might not provide the funding to build a wall. They might not do a few things, although that might be more likely on the Democratic side. But, you know, we've got to get something that stands as a watchdog over what these two candidates might do if they get elected to president. All right. I hope you enjoyed the show. It wasn't a very optimistic show. It's hard to be optimistic these days. But let me leave you with some recommendations for some great art, inspiring art, art that'll put you in a good mood. And here I'm talking about a couple of pieces of or more than a couple of classical music that I find inspiring, romantic. Oh my God, so romantic, beautiful. Takes you to a different world. It's a way to escape the nonsense of politics. The world is not ultimately driven by politics. You've got to enjoy life. You've got to pursue values. You've got to embrace values. Whoever gets elected, you might want to keep a gun handy, but other than keeping a gun handy, you want to go out there and still find joy in life and still find enjoyment in life. So I'm going to recommend to you a few piano trios. I love piano trios. So it's a piano, a violin, and a cello. Just beautiful, 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 beautiful. And there are a lot of great piano trios. And the ones I'm going to recommend are by Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky, two of the greatest romantic composers ever. And their piano trios are just sweeping, engaging, and thrilling, really, really thrilling. Turn off the lights. I mean, you guys, you don't listen to this kind of music while driving in a traffic jam in a car. This is the kind of music you listen to when you crank up your stereo, you turn off the lights, you recline in the sofa, on the floor, or somewhere. You close your eyes, and you try to focus exclusively on the music. It's a form of meditation, and it's fantastic. Just pretend you're in a concert hall, so you can't talk. There are no noises. You're just focused on the music. Try it. Just do me a favor and try it. Get a CD player, good quality, not a CD player, you can stream it, but decent quality. Turn off the lights, close your eyes, shut out any thought of Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or any other nasty thought that might come into your mind. Just focus on the sweeping beauty of Tchaikovsky's Trio Number 2, just focus on it, or Rachmaninoff. These are magnificent. They make all this other grotesque stuff disappear and seem, in the big picture, in the grand scheme of things, as insignificant as they really are. All right. Talk to you next week. This is the Iran Brook Show, closing another show.